Session number 23089, Wheel 5.
And again, she was always worried about these new...
Excuse me. And this is Margaret Cornish Rideout, and it's Wheel 5.
Gosh.
Yes, you were saying Daphne was always worried about the
newcomers. Worried about the new recruits, because it was bad enough in fair weather. It was most unfortunate for those two who came on during that dreadful winter. They had the fright of Daphne falling in. They had the terrible experience of the cold in the cabins and not enough food. And they certainly had the wrong kind of clothing. Well, none of us had the right kind of clothing. You see, we had no clothing coupons. I can remember when I first joined, Daphne took me down Commercial Road, and in Bow, in Limehouse, and there was a shop, I think, supplied Sailors, and we were able to get Sailors trousers with flaps off coupons. And I also got some long johns and thick woolen vests, which saved me. Now, the two who joined us, you see, during that cold spell, hadn't been on board when we'd been down at Limehouse. They joined us at Southall, and we were going north to the coalfields, so that they hadn't been able to get any proper clothing. And men's boots, they were absolutely necessary, essential. But, you see, without clothing coupons, you couldn't get anything. There was only this one place that I remember being able to get, I don't know how or why, that we were able to get these sailors' outfits.
And there were no coupons for those? No coupons?
Well, we had no clothing coupons. Yes, we got them without clothing coupons, because we hadn't anything to spare. I mean, clothing coupons were terribly limited. I don't know, clothes, I think, were... Now, Helen Skirm, who was the third member to join myself when I had my own pair of boats, I thought, I wanted my own pair of boats, I thought I knew how to run them. I gathered up a lot of experts. I'd met with Virginia, had come on the training boats, and we got on very well. And she was a very good boatwoman, and she said, if you ever get your own boats. And Helen Skirm, her husband, was a naval commander, a very pucker lady from Salisbury. And funny thing is, when she first was shown the boats, she was shown the cabin, taken on board the cabin. She was waiting to be led through to the proper cabin. She only stayed because she looked at us and she said, if they can do it, I can do it. She's still alive. She's 94. I'm hoping and praying to go and see her. And she worked. She was very careful of her hands. She would wear gloves. And I used to shout at her, take those gloves, because she'd muff the ropes, you know. You had to be very, very manipulate the ropes pretty speedily, because they were used for checking speeds on the butty. The butty depended on ropes, of course, for checking speeds going into locks and so forth. And she used to like working on the motor. She stayed the course, but then she left. When she was going on working boats, she left. But she said, when you get your own boats, I'll come and work with you, but I'm not going to work with anybody else. So she triggered me off to have my own boats, actually, because I was quite happy with Daphne, you know.
Yes, you seem to have had a very good relationship with Daphne.
I did. We did. We got on extremely well together. She was 10 years older than I was, and I was going through rather a bad emotional phase, actually. The boats did wonders for me. Hard physical work, there's nothing like it for getting over heartache. she was tolerant and easygoing and fun. And I don't know, we just did get on. In fact, of course, I went to live in Ireland after I retired from teaching, and spent 9 years and used to go and stay with her in a terrible old ramshackle mobile home. she couldn't care less about it, you know. She just was living on a pittance, and she lived till she was 90. How does About 6 years ago, I suppose, she died.
How long would it have been, Margaret, before you were proficient at your job? You know, before you were fit to train others with Daphne, yeah, or to run your own boat?
Oh,
how many trips?
Well, it varied, of course, and I was pretty good at rope handling. The engine maintenance was something else again. But I got used to the engine and looking after it and so on. I would think I was pretty good. Well, I could, after my two round trips, I did go for a spell on with Susan Wolfitt and Susan Blood and Kay. I did a trip with them. They wanted somebody else, and I did a trip with them. And I found I was, well, easily qualified, yes. I think I was a good boatwoman, you know. I was a natural, I think, for it, because I just loved it. And, I mean, the physical living conditions meant nothing much to me, you know. I wasn't bothered about that. I was lucky that I shared with Daphne. And I found the boat handling, I just could, you know. I think I was quite a natural for it.
Did you find, you know, when you were going on the trips with Daphne, that you had to learn by doing? Was that the way you learned?
Oh, yes, you learn better by doing. All the theory in the world is nothing compared with the doing. You learn that in teaching. Learn by doing. Yes, and the theory comes afterwards. You need the theory to reinforce. Not necessarily on the boats, although I learned a great deal about the history of how the canals were built, you know, the Brindley and the first one, the Duke of Bridgewater and so on, and Telford, and all these wonderful engineers of the past century. They were wonderful people, and it's a terrible shame that the canals were let to go derelict. If it hadn't been for the onset of hoe seasons and the tourist season, which at the time I resented, but thank goodness they were instrumental in reviving the canals before it was too late. And now, of course, not for commerce, but for holidays and tourists, they are, of course, expanding. They're being opened all over the place. And a great deal of work being done, of course, by wonderful groups of volunteers who have done wonders. And I know when I had my own boat and lived on the Alphonse for 5-6 years, and I used to be so cross. I know all these wonderful people doing, spending weekends doing heavy work, dredging out canals, mending lock gates, putting them together. And then you get the cowboys who'd come on the canals with no regard at all for the proper usage of canals, speeding particularly, which washes the sides of the banks, so that you've got the overhang. But, you know, they would be eroded from underneath. And so gradually, you know, they would collapse. And then you get piled up mud on each side. They would just narrow the channel and narrow the channel. Again, that was another thing we learned. The canal, there is what we used to call the road through. And it was kept open because, again, maintenance was absolutely minimal, even when we were working in the war. And so you kept to what we called the road. And if you can imagine that there was piles up of mud on each side, but the passage of boats kept the road open. So you made sure that you kept to the road. And going round these bends, the pile up of mud would be on the offside. So you very carefully kept to the road round the outside of the bend. Otherwise, you'd stick yourself on the mud, and it was terrible to get a heavy loaded boat off the mud once you were on it. It was very difficult indeed. So the road had to be kept open by the constant movement of boats keeping to this very narrow waterway, which was deep enough. I mean, the boats themselves threw the mud to each side. And you see, people, newcomers on the canals, don't understand. Even to put stakes, mooring stakes, we never allowed, well, only very rarely, to put mooring stakes in the banks, because they themselves would erode the banks. And piling the banks was Well, very little was done. More is being done now, I know. And you get sections on the, what is it, on the K&A, the Kennet-Naven, which are really being turned into sort of mechanised tanks. You know, the tank, they're just mechanised metal sides and metal bottoms, which to me takes away all the excitement of what a real canal is about. However, I suppose they're functional, and K&A is a very delightful canal.
The you've described so well, you know, the maintenance situation. Did you, were you very carefully monitored for speed during the war?
Yes. Again, the toll, the places where you were gauged for toll, there was no, no great thing that you'd done it in such a time. You'd been going too fast then. You were judged according to your time and the distance that you had taken for that time as to whether you were exceeding. And, of course, the lock keepers, and we had lengthmen, lock keepers were also lengthmen, were also very vigilant. The only people, the only pairs, that even they were restricted. You had governor rods, which were the accelerator, which you could not, I mean, some of the boat people, I gathered, used to manipulate them so they could get up at greater speed. We could not go above three miles an hour, I think it was. The flyboats, of course, which carried beer, Watney's beer, and the Ovaltinis, they went day and night on a rotor system of, it was very hard going, a rotor system of crew, which meant the wife would be taking her turn at the butt. They were called flyboats, and you always let them go by you. Even if you had the locks ready for you, if the flyboats were coming up behind you, you let them go. They went night and day to get to deliver this drink. I think they were Watney's ale or something. And I believe up north there were more of them. They were carrying oil. I didn't know much about it. There was a scheme north of Birmingham, but I didn't know much about it. I still don't know much about it. I know there was a scheme, and there were a few women working then on the big wide boats on the Leeds-Liverpool. I travelled the Leeds-Liverpool, but it, later on in years, we had a little cruiser, plastic, fiberglass cruiser, which was perfectly adequate. Took four of us quite comfortably, and we travelled all up through the Leeds-Liverpool, which is a beautiful canal, right up through the Pennines.
Were horses used on the canals during your time, you know, in the war in particular?
No, only one. It was run by Rose and Joe and Rosie Skinner on the Oxford, because they weren't really practical on the big, wide double locks on the Grand Union, which took two boats side by side. And of course, when the national motorised boats came in the 20s, I think the horses disappeared almost overnight, except on the very narrow canals. And the Oxford was narrow, and there were stables along the route that were still used, but on the Grand Union they were all disused by the time we were on. And only Rosie and Joe Skinner on their boat called the Friendship. They were a delightful couple, lovely couple. And I remember talking to Rosie at the top of Nap and sort of quite envying her the horse, because at the time our motor had broken down and we were waiting for a fitter. And she said, he was called Arthur, and she said, it's all right if you get a good horse, but you get a bad one and you can be absolutely exhausted by the end of an hour.
Did the women do much the same work as men on the boats?
They did, indeed. They had to. They were the mate. They were always referred to as the mate. The steerer was the man. And, of course, there were a little diversion here. the number ones, as they were known, who actually did not work for a company but owned their own boat. And they were rather superior. And they were known as the number ones. And there were a few of them. And, of course, the wife was always referred to as the mate. And she was, in every kind of way. As the woman, as one of the women said to me, as I mentioned, I think, previously, she said, not only do we have to do all the work on the boat, all the boat work, but we had the kids and the men to and the feeding and everything to do, and the washing. And it was a very, very hard life. Life expectancy, of course, was pretty short. And if they could, their whole aim was to get on shore, to have a cottage in Braunston. That was the village, was the home for many of the retired boat people. And if they could retire before they died, that was where they would hope to be.
Yes, one sees pictures of women pulling the boats.
Oh, yes, yes, they did. They had to do the lock wheeling. I mean, they had to. The man was in charge of the motor, and as I've told you, the motor took every bit of your attention. And so we worked the boats, three women between two, and it kept three of us fully occupied. There was one to be doing the steering on the motor, one to be doing the steering of the butty, and the third person, you needn't think you'd ever be off. You'd be either lock wheeling, getting ready the locks, or helping up the locks, or you would be cleaning the brass, or you would be cooking, or you would be on the bicycle shopping. There was always plenty to occupy three unattached women, so you can imagine what the man and his mate had to do the lot between them, plus all the children and the washing and everything. So it was a very hard life.
It's interesting you talking of bikes. Did you have a bike?
Oh, yes, you had to have a bike to go lock wheeling. That, you know, lock wheeling meant that you went ahead of the boats to the lock. And if it wasn't ready for you, for instance, if you were going uphill and you went ahead and the lock was full of water, well, you had to empty it and get the boat and get the gates open, ready for the boats to enter when they arrived without checking, you know. A bike was... they were usually kept either on the coal, when we had coal, or on the cabin top. And incredible, you knew the exact stepping off places where you could, one foot on the gunwale, grab the bike with one arm and step off very neatly onto the towpath. And of course the towpaths weren't in very good repair. There were great potholes and great loops. You would be jumping your bike over a place where the canal, where the bank had subsided. I mean, it was fraught with all kinds of unhidden dangers. The best place, of course, when you could arrange it, and of course you've got to know the road precisely, you've got to know every inch of it, where you could step on and off, where the bridge holes, under the bridges, where you see it's narrowed, and you get close in. The water is deep in a bridge hole. And if you got anything in, I mean, we used to pick up rubbish. Luckily, no plastic in those days. Plastic bags are the curse of the canals these days, I think. But you pick up sacks, bed springs, anything in the propeller, in the prop. So you would aim to get, and that would foul the engine, black smoke would erupt. And you knew that you had to prod with the, we had two shafts known as quant poles on the Broads. But we had a short shaft, which was about 6 feet, and the long shaft, which was twice as long, for pushing off from the bank. But the short shaft, you would get the boat into the back end of the engine, into the bridge hole, push off with the short shaft, so it was away, a foot would be used to push it off. And with the short shaft, you'd have to prod the propeller to get whatever was wound round the propeller free. Couldn't always do it. You couldn't always get it. I remember tugging a great overcoat once, and it was absolutely wound round and round and round. And I went in with the bread knife. I mean, it was obviously warmer weather. So I went in with the bread knife to hack off the remains from the propeller to free it. Yes, there are these sort of hazards. I think I remember in later years the canal on the Leeds Liverpool above Burnley and Blackburn were dreadful. There were all kinds of shopping trolleys, mattresses, plastic bags. Of course, I do remember they were there then. Mm-hmm. And the only way, if you knew something was coming, was to idle through so that propellers weren't turning, and hope that you'd glide over. Certainly in the bridge holes, where the stuff used to accumulate, you would reckon to have enough speed to go into neutral so the blades would not be turning, and you would just slide through, you hoped. Sometimes it worked.
But talking as you earlier were of the boat people, you mentioned earlier how there was this sort of etiquette. There were certain rules and regulations.
Yes, privacy are most important. Mm. You never stepped on another's boat without being invited. And you never talked to the men. Certainly, you know, you were always very wary of talking to the woman first, as females, because, of course, they weren't used to seeing. If you walked out with a man, I mean, you were engaged. It was as narrow as that. And what else was there? Oh, I mean, there was all the etiquette of going up locks. You would never take... If you were going uphill and there was a boat coming downhill, there were boats coming downhill, well, you wouldn't draw... We used to say draw off a lock, because it would waste a lock full of water. You would wait for the oncoming boats to come through, because they would then make the locks ready for you to go up. And it would be very... and, of course, water was precious. I mean, it was only a canal, after all, and there were only very few places where there was inflow of water to fill up the levels, apart from rain. And we had side ponds, which we had to use. Now, what the name describes, they were ponds alongside a lock. And how can I explain it? A lock full of water could be emptied from the side pond into the lock instead of drawing that amount of water from the canal itself. And when you emptied the lock, you had to empty it into the side pond. You could top up from the canal itself, but you had to use the side pond water first to conserve water. Now, that's all gone, of course, and the side ponds are all filled in. I haven't seen a hair of a side pond for ages. But they were very insistent, and quite rightly so, that we used... I mean, obviously, we wanted the canal, the boat people themselves wanted the canal to be kept going, so they were very keen on conserving the water because their livelihoods depended on it. So you would never risk wasting water by taking a lockful when a lockful would be available by an oncoming pair. Again, we as women, we were very aware that we could hold up. We weren't so quick, certainly in the early days. We weren't so so speedy as the boat people. So we would always, what we called, loose them by, let them go ahead, in other words. We would, very carefully keep out of the way as far as was humanly possible. You didn't want to get yourself on the mud. But I remember there was the one incident that I do describe in the book, when we were very expert, actually, the three of us. We worked very well together. And we were No, it wasn't. I was with Susan Blood and Susan Wolfert then. Of course I was. It was on the Oxford at Aino. No, was it Aino? Anyway, Shepbrook Corner, that's right. And the python, he was a single motor, and he was stuck fast across the corner. He got his bows absolutely, and he was absolutely wedged. And I was on the motor of these two boats. Susan Blood was the steerer, but she was not well or something, because she used to like to take the motor. Anyway, we came up with a pair, and there he was stuck at Shepbrook Corner. Now, what did I do? I could risk easing by, maybe getting stuck myself, pushing him further on, in which case I would have been in dead trouble. I couldn't stop. There was nowhere, you couldn't really stop anywhere. I didn't know, I had to risk it. So I know Susan was on the butty. She was absolutely petrified, she told me later. I eased right down, and he was, and of course it was terribly infra-dig for a boatman to be seen stuck across the corner. And of course there was no sign of him. He kept, you knew very well that he would be watching every single move, but there was no sign of him. So I came up very slowly, and somehow I edged past without touching him. I dared not touch him. And then I had to get the butty round, and that wasn't easy. And I managed to get my stern out and shorten the strap so that I pulled the bows round. And we, anyway, cut a long story short, we got both the boats round. And then I loosed off. I said, you go, I'll offer him a snatch. Now, by that time, his head had appeared from the engine room doors, that's on the side. And he said, engine room trouble, engine trouble. That was a let out. That's okay. So I said, can I give you a snatch? He sort of looked at me. This boat was called the Python, I'll never forget it. Anyway, he decided to accept it, and I gave him a snatch, as I called it. In other words, I threw off a rope, and he attached it to his... No, he got to his fore end, threw me a rope, and I pulled his bows off, so that he was freed. And he didn't... I don't think he ever said thank you, but, you know. What his thanks... He could, with a single motor... In fact, I idled the boat so that he had the chance to pass me and go ahead, and he didn't. He let me go. And that was enough thanks for me, that he had recognised, you know, that I had done a good job, and we went ahead of him. But I used to pass him occasionally, but he always slouched behind the chimney. That was your wonderful way of hiding. You had your chimney, you sort of crouched behind, with your back to the bank or to the passing boat, and you didn't need to acknowledge. And we used to do that on the Oxford on the Sunday mornings, when the fishermen were all out having their behind their green umbrellas, having their fishing competitions, and they used to hate, they used to resent the boats, because of course they had to. I mean, it was only very narrow. The canal was places the width of this room. So you were very close, and that's when I used to hide behind my chimney, passing these, as I call them, Buddhas on the bank. And they'd have to, as we progressed, have to lift their rods as we passed. It was like a ceremony going, with all the rods lifting in sequence as we went past. So the chimney was a very good protection, actually. You used to hide behind it. And the greeting, normally speaking, when two boats met each other, we always passed on the right, incidentally, not the left, the left. It was always, how do, how do? How many ready? How many rocks ready? How many locks have you left ready? And of course you had to remember, how many locks have I come through, for goodness sakes, without meeting any boats coming the other way? And we used to be a great effort of will to try to remember. They could remember, of course. They had visual memories, that they would pinpoint every pair of boats on their internal mental map, so that they would know precisely where every pair of boots was to be found. They had a visual image imprinted on their minds of the whole network, and they would know where anybody was. So if you ever went to the, if you ever wanted to know, and you went to the canals and you wanted to know where, seen Daphne, seen Cat, yeah, she'd be up at the arm, she'd be up at, they'd know exactly where they were, where you were to find them. And of course Helen Skirm, who was my third member, her husband, who was this naval commander, and when he came on leave, Helen used to want to go on leave as well. So we, that was all right, because Virginia and I worked very well two-handed, and we didn't mind. And she was such a, she used to bring us food.